Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to...
Thank you all for joining us tonight. We have a really good person coming on tonight. His name is George G. And he's going to share his story about his road to recovery. So with that being said, welcome to the show, George. Hi.
Anin in dinaway magniduk. George Gagla indigenous cause Leech Lake Ojibwe here in Minnesota. Cha-Cha Bonding is my community, and I am of the Bear Clan, Makwan Duotem. So it's good to be here tonight.
Thank you for joining us. I'm anxious to learn about you and your story, and I think everybody else would be interested too, because I know when I was telling you earlier, your bio is very interesting. So if you don't mind, would you mind sharing some of or telling everybody a little bit about yourself?
Most certainly. I was pretty much raised here on the Leech Lake Reservation. Most of my life, I come from two parents who have themselves been immersed in the Anishinaabe cultures. My father is a fluent speaker. My mother is not a fluent speaker, but she is very, very culturally oriented and is familiar with the stories and the history of our community, and she shares quite a bit with me about that. So, you know, my earliest memories go back to a time when I was about 3 years old here in my community of Cha-Cha Bonding, or we call it Inger. My relationship with people goes back to about that age when I could remember, and it reminds me of a person that was part of my life at that early age, and what we did is we called each other a word that is familiar in the older language here of the Ojibwe Ojibwe language, and it's called Gakaujigan. She called me Gakaujigan, and I also call her Gakaujigan, which is we were calling each other the person who I'm connected to. So that just kind of gives me an idea. I want to give people an idea, you know, where I began my life and how I began my life. It was around people who spoke language, lived the Indian way, the Anishinaabe way. And then my parents got married and we moved away. I became a Navy brat, and so we spent time different places, Florida, Virginia, eventually moving back here when I was about 7 or 8 years old. And this is where, you know, I pretty much spent the rest of my life growing up here and watching what was going on, having an influence of grandparents on both sides and knowing of the culture, knowing of the traditions and the ceremonies that were, you know, that were part of our way of life. So that's a little bit about me. And I have three adult children. They have blessed me with, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 grandchildren.
Oh wow!
I take that role very seriously. It is a teaching. It is a teaching role that I think, you know, many may not understand that, especially in our way. You know, we have a responsibility to these young people when they come into our lives, and so it's been really special for me because I have been sober, clean and sober for all of their lives, which is something that means a lot to me. It's I haven't been sober, you know, for much of my life, but I have been sober a great deal of my children's life, and all of my grandchildren's life. So that's that's a little bit about me.
Well, I think that's great that you've come along as far as you have with it. Do you want to kind of take us back into what started you with the journey to recovery and tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, absolutely. And again, it's it's a long journey. It's a journey that started here with the growing up, the role models, the people that I've seen, what I observed. There was a mixture of positive, mixture of negative. And as a young person, I started to follow the trail that probably wasn't the most positive. And it took me down the trail of abuse, either, with drugs and alcohol. It took me down the path of domestic abuse with my first wife. It took me off to school in the boarding school. Before that, it took me into the military. It took me a lot of different places, and the one thing that I was able to do is I could still function and do okay and maintain employment and do a lot of those things. But it eventually it just progressively got worse, and over time it became a really bad situation where the abuse became much more. I became abusive to my wife at the time, we didn't have a very, very good relationship at all, because the relationship really was centered around alcohol and among other things, real negative behavior. But we had children at the time, and so it was really important for us to try and maintain some level of stability so that we could raise our children together. And of course, it didn't happen that way. And we had ended up splitting up and divorcing in the early 90s. And this was all due to the use of alcohol, the use of drugs, and a lot of abusive situations, and it was really best that we separate and not be together for the sake of our children, because what we were showing them was an unhealthy lifestyle, and we wanted to make sure that they didn't pick that up. But that's a whole nother story there too. But eventually, I continued to walk down the path of destruction, and things got worse. Got myself into another relationship, and that too was built around a little bit of drinking of alcohol, a little bit of drug use, smoking marijuana, but it wasn't as bad. I guess I'm not going to say that it wasn't really bad, but progressively, anybody that's an alcoholic or a drug addict may be able to stop or slow down their drug use for a period of time, but yet eventually you get back to a point where you were, and your progression does pick up, and that eventually happened. And so this all happened right around mid 90s. Tried to get my act together again, and maybe stayed sober for several months, maybe close to a year, and just to try and improve my life and the relationship that I was starting with this wonderful woman. And unfortunately, it didn't really turn out that way, and I still continued to use. I was still drinking, and but I thought maybe, proposing to get married would maybe change me somewhat. And, you know, and that's the kind of thinking that us alcoholics and drug addicts kind of have. We think that we can change if we do something that might make us commit to being a better person, but that's not always the case. And that's similar here too. That went on. We got married in 1998, and the drug abuse and alcohol abuse actually got worse. It got to the point where I was involved with using methamphetamine. I was using cocaine. I was using the crank that was around at the time, and I was drinking a lot too. And so that was really really a point where my life began to spiral downward and really take a toll on the relationships that I had with my wife at the time, with my children, with my stepchildren, who were a big part of my life at the time too. I had no relationship with really anybody, my parents. The only relationship that was important to me was the relationship that I had with myself. And I was all about taking care of me. And that's one of those things that, you know, as an alcoholic or a drug addict, we tend to be very, very selfish. And we only do things that will benefit us in any situation. Doesn't make a difference. I mean, sure, it might be something that I might do with my kids, but how is this going to benefit me? Or how is this going to make me look in the community? And, you know, that's the way I looked at things. So, you know, for about the next 4 years, I just continued to spiral downward, and I managed to continue functioning as an alcoholic and a drug addict. But people were starting to see, and they were catching on to me. And the drug use was going on in the work environment. The drug use was going on almost on a daily basis. In fact, sometimes I was so high on methamphetamine or crank that I didn't sleep for 2 or 3 days. Sometimes I would go home and I'd lay in bed and I'd try to lay still, you know, for 5 or 6 hours just so that I could pretend to be sleeping. And it got that way, and it was really, really difficult to try and balance, you know, life. And then in about 2000, I started doing something that I wasn't real sure about, but I did it anyway. And I started snorting pills, and I started snorting OxyContin, Vicodin, Tylenol 3s, Tylox, anything that, you know, I could crush up and make into powder form and take up my nose. I did. And there was one particular time that, and it was near the end of my drinking and using days, is that I overdosed and I collapsed here in my community, in my village, when I was around others, some family members or friends. And I collapsed on the ground. And I remember and I recall vividly how my body ached, how I was in pain. And I felt like, I don't know how dying feels, but I guess I can describe it as having a feeling like I was going to die, because there was so much pain throughout my body. And here it was the OxyContin's reaction to the alcohol. And there was always that, you know, there was always that knowledge in the back of my mind that I could not drink alcohol and use OxyContin at the same time. But I had to try it. I had to prove the theory wrong that I could maintain and I could manage, and I couldn't. So I laid on the ground for what seemed to be, I don't know, I still don't have any idea. I couldn't even tell you how long that was, but all I could remember was my friends and my relatives standing around me asking me if I was okay, asking me if they should call the ambulance. And I said, no, I will be okay. I'll come out of it. I said, just stay here. Don't let anything happen to me if something, you know, please. And it, and I finally did. I actually come out of it, and it, I was scared enough at that time to where I stopped using for a bit. And I thought about how fast life had been before my very eyes, and that at that point in time too, that I realized that I almost died. But you know, that still didn't last very long. I stopped using OxyContin. Never again did I snort another pill. But I continued to pursue, you know, another high, and the high was cocaine. The high was pure crank, and getting such a high out of it, like I said, that I would stay up for 2 or 3 days at a time, and but then I started getting really paranoid too about a lot of things. I started seeing things, I started hallucinating, and then I was drinking on top of that. And little did I know that there was the strong possibility of that mixture killing me. So that took me to about the winter, the fall of about 2001. And I had been on about a 5 or 6 day meth high or crank high. And I didn't know how I was going to be able to come down from that. And so I went to the family's home on the river here in our community. And we had a couple of outbuildings that I went and sat behind. And I don't know how long I sat behind there, but I was shaking. I was cold. And this was probably in August, so it wasn't real cold up here in Minnesota yet. But I recall my mother and my auntie finding me, and they asked me if I was okay. And I said, I think I'm okay. I'm trying to come down. I'm trying to come off of what I was on. And you know, so they, you know, they were crying. I was feeling bad. I was really struggling. And I managed to at least come down off of it at the time. But it didn't take long for me to pick it back up, and I dove back into it really heavy again. And it's like I said, this disease is very progressive, and it doesn't really give you any opportunity to get well. The disease of addiction continues to progress even if you are not doing it, and that's what happened to me through the winter. I kept using. I was drinking more. I was drinking and not being able to get intoxicated because I was so high on either cocaine or meth or crank. And I started thinking about things that spring, March, April, about how much pain I was in, how difficult it was for me to function and live. And I thought about suicide on occasion. I started looking at what possible tree that I could hit that would put me out of this misery that I was in. The one thing I never thought about was how selfish that thought was, that the people that loved me and cared about me, that didn't even cross my mind how this would impact them. Again, in desperation, as an alcoholic and a drug addict, I was only thinking about myself, and that's to end the pain somehow. And it really, it just progressively got worse until about the first week in May, when I was on a bender, and my new wife at the time had brought the boys to come and look for me in one of the communities where we were in a house where we were drinking. We were we were smoking crank, you know, with tin foil and burning it and breathing it in through the straws and you know, doing as just not having a care in the world. And you know, the boys told me one thing. They said that mom says that you, one was my stepson, the other one was my biological son. They said, mom says you got one or two choices. You can choose this life, you know, or you can choose us. And that thought was enough to make me think about what was important in my life. It didn't stop me from drinking that night. It didn't stop me from using the rest of that night. But what it did do is it made me think about what I needed to do so that my life would be better and so that I could be the person that I needed to be for the people that cared about me. The two boys were pretty clear, and their mom was pretty clear about things too. So what I did that weekend is I walked away. It happened to be the opening of the fishing season here in Minnesota, and I remember it clearly because I'm not far from the bridge where people fish, and there's an annual fishing contest that the community holds every year. And I remember there was people down there, and I was looking out the window, and I could see them. And I was coming down off of being high. And, you know, I was talking to one of my relatives, and I was asking him to bring me a bump so I could maintain. And, you know, he didn't have anything. And it really put me in the position where I had to come down because I wasn't willing to leave. I didn't want to go anywhere because, you know, I was starting to feel really ashamed of my behavior. I was starting to feel real tired of how I was living. And so stayed in the house, and I didn't go anywhere. I think a couple of people came, knocked on my door, but I didn't answer the door. I just wanted to try and come down and see what would happen. And I was able to make it until Sunday. And then I woke up. I think I woke up from a short nap. And maybe I didn't even sleep. But I remember there was a number that I could call, a friend of mine who happened to be my ex-brother-in-law, who I still have a great relationship with today. He told me that he could help me if I needed help. And I called him, and basically I said, I have to get into treatment. If I don't get into treatment real soon, I know I'm going to die. I don't want to die. I think I have much more to live for than any reason to die. I said, but I need to do it. I said, I can't wait. If I wait, I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I can handle it. Well, anyway, my friend, who ended up being my sponsor later on, was able to get me into a detox unit within a couple of days. And he assured me, he said, whatever you do, don't give up. He said, I will get you in, just believe. And so I did. I believed that he would do that. And he did get me in. Like I said, I got into detox. When I got done with the detox period, I was able to find a bed right there within the recovery unit as well. And so I spent 28 days in early May, mid-May to mid-June of 2002. And I don't know if anybody is ever ready for treatment, but at the time I was. I wasn't on a court-ordered commitment. I wasn't, I didn't have to go in front of a judge, and I wasn't, you know, I didn't have to do this. I was fortunate enough to be one of those people who wanted to. And so that was the beginning of my recovery phase, and this was of May 15th, 2002. So I spent time in the treatment center, began to reconnect with the culture, the spiritual part of it, began to talk openly about my problem, began to work the steps as they were laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I always connected to the cultural and the spiritual side of my life, because that was something that was always there. That was something that was with me from the time that I was born, and from the earliest memories that I have. It was there, and I knew that it was there, and that was something that was important for me to go back and revive that, because my spirit knew that. And so that was one of the big pieces of that 28 days or that 38 days, was acknowledging the fact that I have this. There's things that I have been gifted with throughout my time. You know, one of them was the pipe that my father and grandfather gave me before I was deployed to Beirut in 1983. They did a ceremony for me to make sure that I would come back, that I would be okay while I traveled, and they made sure that everything would work out the way it is supposed to. Even the fact that I was able to bring my pipe with me, and my commanding officer completely understood what this was about, and I thought there would be questions about it, but I was able to bring that with me. So, you know, fast forward again back to that period of time. That pipe was waiting for me when I got home. It was put away in a safe place here in the home that I have today, that I live in today here in Chachibaning, and got the pipe cleaned out, took it into the sweat lodge and began to use it again. And, you know, that changing a lot of things about my life. One of them was the attitude. The other one was how I viewed things. The most important thing was to separate myself from the friends that I had grown up with, the relatives that I had grown up with, the brothers and sisters that I had spent my whole life being around. I had to take myself out of that picture in order for myself to be healthy and to be well. And, you know, some very life-changing experiences. Because it becomes kind of lonely in that first year, and I think that's one of the hardest parts of the recovery process is finding out what you need to do, finding out what is important, and then doing those things. You know, going back to the meetings that I started going to while I was in the treatment center every Friday night, instead of, you know, waiting to get off work and go sit in a bar and have a couple beers, which turned out to be all night or even all weekend events sometimes. You know, it was about making the kind of commitment to an old lifestyle, the same kind of commitment to a new lifestyle, but, you know, doing so to where I would actually start developing better ways of dealing with life, because to me, having an alcohol and drug problem is really the inability to live life, and not having the tools to navigate through life. Even though all along, you know, those were instilled within me, you know, at a very young age with the teachings and the guidance. So those things went on for the better part of that first year. It was a constant effort to make sure that I got to meetings, to work on the relationship that that I was in, the to recommit to that marriage and recommit to raising children and at the time, you know, getting ready to become a grandfather, because the little ones, the children were starting to have kids right around that time. So it was also important for me to make sure that they would never see me in a drunken stupor or high, or they knew that I was, because they asked me about it as they got older. You know, they asked a lot of questions about life. You know, how come you guys don't fight, Papa? Because, well, we don't have any reason to be fighting. Well, my parents are always fighting. I'm like, well, yeah, there's issues. Or how come you don't drink, Papa? How come you don't smoke cigarettes? How come you don't smoke, you know, weed? And it's like, but, you know, it's you're just being honest with them, and you tell them, you know, that's not a way that I want to live my life anymore. I mean, there's just too many more important things. And so, you know, within that first couple of years, I think the first 5 years of the recovery process, you realize how important change is to you and what you need to do to make those changes. And it is, it's detaching from others. It's making sure that you build a network of people and friends that you can count on, basically, that you can turn to when you need someone to talk to. Because your spouse is not someone who you really want to place a lot of responsibility in for your actions. You know, you want to be able to be an individual that can be supportive and that can be, you know, be the person that you made a promise to be. And that's still never easy, no matter what you do in life. And I think, you know, that as time progressed, you know, people will change too. So, but that commitment, that first 5 years, there was still something that was missing in that time. And I think it was around that time too that I got elected into the chairman position for the Leech Lake Tribe here in Minnesota. And that was probably one of the most difficult periods of my life, because it really took me away from some of the most important things in my life, and that was my family. I didn't use drugs or go back to alcohol during that time, but there was some other behaviors that resurfaced and came back that were behaviors directly related to unhealthy lifestyle, the drinking, the drugging, you know, going into bars and sitting around other people who were drinking and those types of things. That started to happen, and it was really unhealthy for me, and it really shaped my chain of thinking. It altered the way I thought about a lot of things. It made me see things from a different perspective, and it wasn't always the best. But a position like that too is you are granted a great deal of responsibility, and people put a lot of trust and faith in you. And the problem was is that I let a lot of people down. I didn't live up to being the kind of person that I thought that I should be. In fact, I let my family down more importantly than anything else. And I don't regret the amount of time that I spent in that capacity. But what I do regret is that I wasn't the family person that I needed to be. Other things were more important than my family, and it showed. But the fact is that, you know, like I said, I lost the election in 2008, and that was the beginning of another change in life for me, because you go from a position to where you are in the public eye, you're a public figure, and then you go into kind of an obscure where you're not where you're not out there in the public anymore. And so it really gave me an opportunity to focus on some things that were missing in my life. Here I thought all along that my life was very spiritual, that I was living a spiritual life, but I really wasn't. It wasn't until after that election was over and I lost that I realized that the most important thing in my life had been missing all along, even though I thought it was there, and that was that spiritual way of living. One can walk around with a pipe, and one can go to ceremony, and one can do all kinds of things. But if you're not walking the walk, you really can go through life and you can be clean, you can be sober, but you won't be happy. You won't be you won't be okay with things. And so it took some time after that to realize that my life was probably negatively impacted by that period of time, and I needed to do something about it. And so it was around that time that I really began to get back into the sweat lodge with my father, begin to participate in ceremonies, with people. Namely, my father was the one that we would do a lot with. And that really made the difference in my life. And it also helped me to start see how important it was for me to learn and to understand, what our culture is about. Because at that time, all the grandchildren were starting to be about 5, 6 years old. They were starting to ask a lot of questions. They were starting to want to know. There was that, the question was always why. When I was explaining something to one of the grandkids, they would say, why? Why, Papa? Why? And so it's important. It was important for me to be able to provide the answers to them, because, eventually responsibility to teach becomes ours. It's talked about in every culture that the elders, are going to be required to do that. So I really jumped into improving the way my relationship, I should say, with my higher power, Geshe Manidu, the Great Spirit, is what I refer to him as. And as I began to do more and more of that, my recovery became a lot stronger. It became more meaningful and more purposeful to me. I was able to start sharing the message of recovery with more and more people. I was able to go to college and graduate. Graduated from college in 2013. I started working with other alcoholics and drug addicts, males, of course. Starting providing sponsorship to male alcoholics and drug addicts, helping to guide them through the challenges of the program. That became a calling for me, and so it was that point in about 2013 that I realized how important it was to not focus on my needs, but to focus on the needs of people around me. And it took some time. Like I said, there's always a period of growth, and I think at every stage of our life where excuse me, I had to take a drink. Where we realize that we have to make a change, because to stay stagnant is not the human way. It's certainly not the Anishinaabe way. So it's important to continue learning as you go through life and make the changes and understand that the changes are all around us, you know, whether they're the seasons, whether it's a tree, whether it's the grass, and then watching children, babies grow up and to be children, and then children grow up to be adolescents and adolescents become adults. And then of course, watching those who came before us, as our parents become grandparents, become great grandparents, and then eventually, you know, venture on to the spirit world. You know, understanding life as it is, and the wonderful gift that we are given here all the time that we're, you know, that we're allowed to be here in this physical being. Those are the things that really help me to focus on my recovery today. I work in the capacity of a human services director for the tribe, and it allows me to do things in and around the recovery community and work with many, many wonderful people in the recovery area. I have friends that probably stretch across the whole United States right now. I've got friends here in this community. We're seeing a wonderful movement. You know, Sober Indians is just a wonderful network of people. We're seeing another grassroots movement called Sober Squad. Shout out to, you know, my brothers and sisters out there, you know, carrying the message and showing people that there's a better way of living. You know, these are all things that have come as a result of, you know, living this way of life. Some of my younger friends, we talk, you know, every now and then, and talk about the message and talk about just being a role model. And you know, being the person that they looked up to when they started this journey, and still being a part of their life today, you know, recovery is there's a lot of challenges in the recovery area, because you do, once you make that decision that you want to live a different life, you make decisions and you make changes. To a lot of things, your attitude about things, the people that you hang out with, the things that you do. I think people are finding out how much fun doing things sober can really be. Golfing, fishing, outdoor events. I do a lot of different things, you know, outside. To me, I've always loved being outside. I'm a gatherer, I'm a hunter, I'm a fisherman. These are all things that I grew up doing and understanding, and so I still continue to do those things today. But sharing, you know, with others too about how I got to where I'm at is really important. Because not only does it help me, but I think it really helps the others too that are out there that are looking for a way to get out their unhealthy situations. You know, we still have so much of that going on. The alcohol abuse, maybe not so much anymore, but the drug abuse, domestic abuse, trafficking, you know, that's still going on out there, and a lot of our young people are still engaged in that activity. I see it almost on a daily basis. You see the impact that the drug issue, the drug abuse has had on our communities, and our communities are every single community, I think, here on Leech Lake has is suffering in a lot of ways because of you can access any drug here, and so it doesn't really give our young people a chance sometimes because it's so accessible, and kids growing up watching their parents using drugs and being left home alone. And I mean, it happens every single day. I'm the caregiver of a granddaughter right now because of because of the issue of drugs and alcohol. She came to me a year ago, Christmas Eve, and I've had her ever since. And she knows, she's been exposed to so many different things. In fact, we went to her home a couple of months after she had been with me just to see what we could find for clothes. And of course, we walk in and the first thing I find and we see is needles, on the counter that had been there for probably a couple months. But that's what the kids see. And so it's really important for us to give them something other that's positive, engaging in different activities and positive things in the teachings and sitting down and actually spending time with these young people, because it's important for them to know. And that's how, I really believe that, our people are going to heal when we start to take the time to teach and spend with them and give them hope. And the only way that we can give them hope is if we ourselves are of the right mind, body and spirit. And that means that, we have to be clean. We have to be, we have to be abstinent. We have to, we have to demonstrate that we are living that life, that good life. We call it Bemah Tsiwa in Ojibwe, so that they can do that too. There are so many other forms of treatment or harm reduction, and I'm not discrediting any single one of them, because I think it's important for people to find their way, regardless. But my hope is that in every single case, whether it be through medical assisted therapy, whether it be through abstinence programs, White Bison, the 12 step programming, Narcotics Anonymous, whatever those programs may be, that they find themselves at some point, not needing to use anything to help them, but using the tools that the Creator has blessed us with. And going back and finding, the culture, finding the language and finding those teachings and being able to live by those. Those are the most important things. And many of my brothers and sisters that are out there now, I see them. I observe what they're doing, and it just, to me it makes my heart really happy, because these teachings are happening. These men, these women who may not have been in the program as long as I have, or others even longer than me, they're picking up and they're conducting these lodges. They're holding drum ceremonies. They are sitting at the drums, singing the songs. They are making regalia, and they are dancing. They're getting back into the circle. They're out in the outdoors during our seasonal activities, and they're engaging in the Skamizagan, the sugar camps, our Manoman harvest, are fishing, and you know, there's so many of these things that are out there, and that's what our people have to become part of again, because it, you know, again, that's what they tell us. That's how we're going to heal, is when we go back to doing many of the things that we used to do. Understanding the seven teachings. Before I came on tonight, I had a chance to listen to my wonderful friend Kagi Gabo from the Minneapolis area talk about the seven teachings and the seven grandfather teachings. And you know, I've listened to that several times, but each time that I have the opportunity to sit down and listen again, I learned something even more deep about those teachings. You know, these are important things to all of us if we are to become healthy, if we are to become you know, better parents, better grandparents, better sons, better fathers, better mothers. Because that's one thing that alcohol and drugs have really, really impacted is our family structure. And so it's really, really an important part of that healing process is to understand, you know, our people, our mothers, they need to be mothers to their children. The fathers need to be fathers to their children. You know, because they're going to become grandparents, and those grandparents are an important part of those children's life. And the reason why I say that, because when Kagi Gabo talks about those seven teachings, he also talks about the seven generations, which brings me back to the beginning of my story tonight when I talked about this person I call Gaka Ujigan. We were five generations apart from each other, but she was part of my life, and she was part of my upbringing. She left something here for me that was important, and that was an understanding of a connection that I have to people that were here before me. We have to remember that those people that were here seven generations ago, eight generations ago, nine generations ago. In fact, I could probably go back in my family to about eight or nine generations and the individuals that were here. You know, they did something for us, and what they did was they prayed for us. They prayed that our life would be good, that we would have the things that we need. But they also knew that there was going to be some changes that would happen, and some of those changes that they were aware of was the introduction of alcohol, the introduction of drugs, you know, opiates. Opiates are not new to our community. They were the opiates were introduced to our relatives along the Great Lakes as early as the 1600s. They were used, you know, to put in the alcohol to put our relatives to sleep so the trade could go a lot easier. And this is, you know, this is actually documented in the in a book by Charles E. Cleland. And I forget the title of it right offhand, but I will remember at some point. But it talks about, in one piece of the book, it talks about how the fur traders used opiates and mixed it in the rum and gave it to the Anishinaabe people so that it would virtually put them to sleep, and then they could manipulate the trade. So opiates are not something that's new. Our people were exposed to it, you know, three and a half centuries ago. It's only been reintroduced here in the last, you know, few decades, four or five decades maybe, I don't know. But it's really had an impact on our people. And so it's changed a lot of things. It's changed the way we see things. It's changed the way an elder looks at things. It has really impacted the teachings. And so when I say that from my heart, that it's important for us as we recover, that we also recover what has been lost to our people, what exists in our spirit, it needs to be brought out, and those are those teachings, the our ways, our cultural ways. You know, we can never go back to a period of time that was 100 years ago, because it's just not going to happen. I mean, I know that my grandparents, who were born in 1917 and you know, around 1910, their way of life was much different from ours. But their teachings are something that's important to our recovery and our survival in the modern time. And so it's really important, like I said, and I can't say enough about that, that, you know, take the time. You are a person in recovery. Learn about those seven teachings. Go to ceremony. Go see your elders and get an Indian, you know, get a spirit name, get an Indian name, and start to know that that's who you are. You know, we all have the English names, but you know, our relatives didn't have those names until the turn of the century, or even, you know, a little bit before that. The non-Indians came here, you know, our way of life changed, you know, for good, and not in a positive way, but more so in a negative way. So, new to recovery, seek out people who are, who have been in recovery for a while. Seek out the teachings. You know, always remember to be open-minded about something, because, you know, a closed mind is a behavior that is really connected to unhealthy mind, unhealthy way of life. Elders are going to tell you what you need to hear. They're not going to tell you what you want to hear. You know, so those are the things that I would say today, because it's really important in the recovery world. If you are Anishinaabe, any native, any indigenous culture, it's really important to go and find who you really are. And I'm not knocking Christianity, and I'm not knocking anything. I'm just saying it's, you know, there's a way that we all can do this. My way was going back to what I've always known, was to grasp the culture piece, to go back and remember the teachings from when I was very small. So that is what I think has really been a big part of my recovery today. It's helped to shape where I'm at now. I am a grandfather. I take that role very seriously. The teachings are something that's so important to me, and I want to be able to walk the walk. And to me, today, it's not as hard to walk the walk as it was, you know, 20 years ago. It gets easier to walk it as I age. So I just want to say, miigwech bidin dawieg. Thank you all for listening.
And thank you for joining us. I did have one more quick question. How many years have you had sobriety now? Years?
It would be over 18 years. It was it'll be 19 years in May of 2021. Wonderful years. Wouldn't change it for the bit. Life has been it's been so much better than it would have been had I not. I think I've certainly extended my life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I agree. And, you know, and I appreciate it. Well, first of all, congratulations on being in recovery that long. I think that's fantastic. And I've enjoyed listening to you talk tonight. It's been very interesting. And I believe that anybody that's listening will take something from this show with you tonight. I appreciate it very, very much.
My pleasure and my honor. It's an honor to be able to speak and to have been asked.
Thank you. And it was an honor for me for you coming on. It was an honor for me for you speaking tonight also. So I want to wish you a good night and thank you once again for coming on and talking tonight.
Miigwech. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, I wanted to thank everybody for tuning in. I'm going to be on for just a few minutes longer, as I do have someone else that is supposed to be joining me tonight and talking a little bit further about addiction and recovery. I hope everyone takes something from this conversation tonight, listening to his story, because it truly is a journey for anyone that's suffering with addiction and finding their way to recovery. So, thank you for joining me.